And welcome back to a Book a Day podcast. And I'm back with another book today. This one that I have with me today, I find it particularly interesting because it's one by one of my favorite writers, Pankaj Mishra. And the book is called Temptations of the West, How to Be Modern in India, Pakistan, and Beyond. And in particularly, he travels in three countries, India, in Pakistan, in Afghanistan. And he kind of makes this observation that these countries, while they are trying to modernize themselves, they are looking up to West, they are trying to westernize themselves, and they still are struggling with that. Because obviously, that kind of goes against their core values. But then they have no other choice because West is something they look up to. That's what they want to become when they get into a more developed state. All these tussles of tradition and modernity, especially when we say modernity in this context, we're talking about westernization. All that is going on. And that's what he observes quite brilliantly, and often you find it amusing. So in today's episode, I thought I would narrate his experience of traveling in Pakistan and what he says about that. So here we go. Let me narrate a few passages from the book. Here we go. Peshawar is a mess. And during my stay there in January 2001, when the smog above the city trapped the acrid smoke from the burning tires that the Afghan refugees huddled around for warmth, and Pakistani traffic policemen wearing new-looking gas masks flailed helplessly in the slow swirl of donkey carts, trucks, auto rickshaws and cars, I began to wonder, somewhat resentfully, if the romance of Peshawar had been an invention of jaded adventurers from the West, of the eager-faced white men and women you could still see walking in the narrow alleys of the old quarters, visitors in the first flush of their enchantment with the Orient, for whom all those aggressively encroaching shanty colonies and the precariously defended middle-class suburbs, all the Afghan beggar children with startlingly green eyes and the heroin addicts slumped on broken pavements could easily fade into the general quietness of the East. 15 years ago, Peshawar had glamour. The Soviet army was in Afghanistan, just 40 miles away, propping up a communist government. And Peshawar was the frontline city for the jihad against Soviet communism that the United States and its allies were sponsoring. Spies from the CIA, KGB, Mossad, and ISI, they all worked the streets and refugee camps where more than 1 million Afghans lived. The local papers were full of cryptic paragraphs about assassinations and bomb explosions. Margaret Thatcher, George Bush, Kirk Douglas, and Princess Anne, among other celebrities, showed up to raise the spirits of the anti-communist Afghan Mujahideen. European and American journalists crowded into Dean's Hotel, waiting to be smuggled onto the battlefield by their favorite Mujahid. At Lala's Grill, local fixers caged kebabs from backpackers looking for the frisson of holy war and gossiped about the number of heroin laboratories near the Khyber Pass. You might even have come across rich Saudis like Osama bin Laden, busy enlisting Arab mercenaries into the jihad. By early 2001, these excitements had died away. except among nostalgic middle-aged local journalists whom the proxy war had temporarily rescued from ill-paid obscurity. Dean's Hotel had closed down a few months before my visit. Lala's Grill had acquired the dark-windowed facade of an Indian-Pakistani dive with pretensions. And although a sign asking visitors not to bring in their guns still stood by the main entrance to the Pearl Continental Hotel, the bright cloth banner outside advertised cooking classes for ladies. I felt oppressed by the city, its shapeless squalor, as well as its new aspirations to respectability, reminded me too much of the small town India I had grown up in. Relief, along with proportion and order, seemed to lie only in the British-created cantonment, in the low red-tiled bungalows, whitewashed trees and brick-lined flower beds, and the lone guard standing stiff before long, smoothly graveled driveways. It was where I often found myself in the long evenings, somewhere somehow longer in an unknown city, browsing through the boldly pirated American and British paperbacks at Saeed Book Bank and visiting newspaper offices in Sadar Bazaar. I was never less than nervous while visiting the cantonment. My visa for Pakistan said, not valid for Kent areas. I wasn't sure what this meant, since cantonment areas in the cities of the subcontinent are impossible to avoid. I was expected to stay away from sensitive military installations. But since I didn't know what these were, I had to play it safe. I never turned my head sideways when my rickshaw passed the grander looking buildings, never made it apparent that I was curious about anything except the dreary progression of the well-paved road and the proud replicas of new Pakistani missiles mounted on traffic islands. The missiles named provocatively after the Muslim conquerors of India. The timidity was partly created by the three men in a beat-up Toyota Corolla who followed me every time I left my hotel. I presumed them to be representatives of one or all of the three major intelligence agencies in Pakistan. But their interest in me seemed exaggerated. A reflex from the days of the spy-infested jihad. It would have mortified the very amiable Pakistani diplomats in New Delhi, who arranged my visa and gave me an Indian writer what I later learnt was an unprecedented liberty of travel within Pakistan. But then to be an Indian in Pakistan, or for that matter, a Pakistani in India, is to be trapped by the prickly nationalisms of the two neighboring countries. It is to be automatically a suspect. Not that the spies did anything or even looked particularly ominous. The most visible amongst them, a plump, rosy-cheeked man in a pink shalwar kurta, could easily have been one of the shopkeepers standing idle behind open sackfuls of dry fruits in the narrow dark rooms of the old bazaar. Still, if you are not used to being followed and watched, it can get stifling. The world seems full of vague menace. The friendly, rather camp bellboy with slick down hair that you think you have tipped generously turns into an ungrateful informer. So does, at one point, everyone else. And the liveliest street scene begins to look like an elaborate preparation for an arrest. Paranoia was what the spies embodied, and then, by their very presence, instilled in me. But there was a deeper unease I felt throughout the first 3 weeks I spent in Pakistan, awaiting to go to Afghanistan. An unease about Islam and Muslims I had so far seen in others. Something I sensed while living in London, in the reports and outraged editorials in the British and American press. about the Taliban and Osama bin Laden and other Islamic extremists, and to which I thought I would be immune after my experience of Kashmir. Tens of thousands of people, militants, soldiers, civilians, have been killed since the uprising began in 1990. The Indian press prefers to describe the situation in the valley as a spillover from the jihad in Afghanistan, the timid Kashmiris having been overwhelmed by Pakistani and Afghan terrorists looking to wage fresh holy wars. This broad picture, which depicted Pakistan and Islamic fundamentalists as the major villains, had blurred and then dissolved altogether during the several weeks I spent in Kashmir the previous year. Most Kashmiris still followed an unorthodox Sufi version of Islam, and the brutalities of the 400,000 Indian soldiers in the valley was what had pushed a small number of young Kashmiri Muslims into extremism. My articles on Kashmir appeared in an American magazine. Soon after they came out, officials from Indian Intelligence Bureau visited my retired parents in India and interrogated them at some length about my pro-Pakistan proclivities. Senior Indian columnists denounced me as unpatriotic, and while wondering what would lead an apparently well-to-do upper-caste Hindu to betray his country in an American magazine, concluded that I was pandering to white pro-Muslim audience in the West. This was optimistic. In the days before 9/11, you wouldn't have known that such audiences existed, judging from the little attention paid to Kashmir or Chechnya, another place where Muslims led a popular but hopeless uprising against a powerful pro-Western nation in the British or American press. Bereft of any recognizable context, the international news pages often seem to offer a kind of brisk atrocity mongering. Part of their purpose seemed to verify the free world's privileges, as with the luxuries on display in the more expansive sections on shopping, food, sex, and celebrities. And Islam, with all its diversity, appeared primarily as the West's other, in the way communism once had been. The aggressive ideology of an underprivileged and dangerously deluded people. It wasn't a conclusion I ever expected myself to reach about Islam and Muslims, particularly when, soon after returning from Kashmir, I thought of traveling to Pakistan and Afghanistan. I wanted to find out more about the CIA-led jihad in the 1980s and the rise of the Taliban, although there were related, specific things that I was curious about. One evening in Srinagar, an old Muslim politician, routinely described as fundamentalist in the Indian papers, had spoken to me of how the West feared Islam even more since the demise of communism, because it alone offered an alternative to the modern civilization of the West. It was hard for me then to work through such large generalizations. Later, when I began to read more in Islamic history, it became clearer to me how quickly, after the centuries of cultural and technological backwardness, the West had caught up with and then began to politically subjugate the Islamic world in the 19th and 20th centuries. As it turned out, it wasn't very difficult to understand how people in demoralized societies could grow inflexible while trying to protect their older lifestyles. But this understanding came from the books I read in London before I spent any time in a Muslim-majority country. And when, not long after I arrived in Peshawar from London, Jamal said, "They are all such fanatics here," I immediately warmed towards him, for I had found myself silently nurturing this commonplace prejudice, although I wouldn't have wanted to articulate it myself. Jamal worked as a sub-editor for the Frontier Post, one of Peshawar's English language dailies, at whose offices I spent many hours on those bleak winter evenings. As I drove up to the box-like narrow building, the three spies parked their car a few meters behind, on an empty lot where scrawny dogs loitered around mounds of assorted rubbish. The men had already ordered tea and barely looked at me as I walked past the pale, mist-blurred lights of the tea shacks. Inside, at reception, an old Pathan in a coarse, textured military coat, hunched over a rickety table, a Kalashnikov leaning against the seat of his wicker chair. On the floor beside his feet squatted a bar heater, and occasionally he would bend towards its weak orange glow. Upstairs, low doors led in and out of one cramped, smoke-filled room after another. And in the room where I usually sat, a windowless cube really, the cigarette smoke stayed suspended in the air, the delicately curled plumes outlined against green walls and brown paper files and aging computers with grimy screens. It was a difficult time for the newspaper. Its owner, a local Pathan businessman called Rehmat Shah Afridi, had been arrested in 1999 on a charge of drugs trading. His son, a young, easily distracted man who ran the paper now, told me that the small amount of cannabis found in his father's Mercedes had been planted there by agents of Mian Nawaz Sharif, then Prime Minister of Pakistan. It seemed like a typical Pakistani story. Big men pursuing small private feuds and vendettas, and perhaps not entirely inaccurate. A few weeks after I left Pakistan, a special narcotics court in Lahore sentenced Afridi to death. In any case, the smaller people were suffering. The staff had been working without salaries for 3 months. But the shared austerity had made people jollier. The door to the room opened every 2 minutes to reveal a newcomer, announcing his presence with a joke, an anecdote, and a curious friendly glance at the visitor from India. A teenage boy, his oversized brown shalwar flapping around his ankles, kept bringing trays full of chipped cups steaming with thick milky tea. The rim of the cup's bottom would be already wet by the time you took your cup. And there were so many visitors that at the end of 3 hours, the broad dusty table glistened all over with small overlapping circles. Jamal was as much of a cigarette catcher and a tea drinker as anyone there. But he looked restless amidst the bonhomie of his colleagues, among whose ruddy, handsome Pashtun or Pathan faces his swarthy, blunt features, so much like that of a South or East Indian looked alien. I often felt his dull yellow eyes fixed upon my face. There was, I sensed, something he wished to tell me in private, and when the moment came early one evening, it was this difference that he was so keen to establish. I hadn't been misled by his appearance. He was a Bengali from Bangladesh. In 1975, when the country was just 4 years old, he had, as a young captain in the Bangladeshi army, taken part in the military coup against the government. He had been present on the morning when the Prime Minister Sheikh Mujibur Rahman and his family were gunned down at their official residence. An accident, he said. We didn't mean to kill him. Whether accidental or not, the moment was firmly in the past, part of Bangladesh's history. But Jamal had spent the quarter century since then dealing with all the consequences. After the 1975 coup, he spent 4 more years in Bangladesh, waging a futile insurgency against the government before finally escaping to Pakistan. There was no other choice. Pakistan, still bitter about its lost province, was the only country that wouldn't deport him straight back to Bangladesh, where he was sure to be executed for Rahman's murder. Jamal hadn't liked his new country one bit, however. He had arrived in Pakistan just as General Ziaul-Haq was beginning his program of Islamization. There was enough of the liberal Bengali, the reader of Tagore and Nazrul Islam, in Jamal to be repelled by the brutal imposition of religion on everyday life. But he couldn't object too loudly. As a political refugee, he had to be grateful that he wasn't being hanged or shot. He had to manage as best as he could. And so he had done moving from job to job, city to city, from one kind of meanness to another. Jamal's story was refined and embellished over several evenings. I wasn't always sure how to respond to it, especially when he added that he had a wonderful book inside him. After all, he had been eyewitness to the murder of Rehman, and the world was still waiting to hear the truth behind those moments in Bangladesh in 1975. The heaviness in his yellow eyes disappeared briefly when he said this. I didn't feel like telling him that all he had was a story, that a book was something else, and that the world wasn't much interested in what had happened that morning in Dhaka all those years ago. I didn't want to discourage or alienate him. He had known such a damaged life, and then only a kind of survival in Pakistan. Besides, he was on my side, a fellow stranger in Pakistan, adrift among the fanatics with whom Pakistan appeared to be, during my first days there, alarmingly replete. There were the black-turbaned, heavy-bearded leaders of the Taliban arriving at their embassy in Islamabad in gleaming new Pajero cars. The retired general in Rawalpindi declaiming on the nobility of jihad. The crudely painted donation boxes for the jihad in Kashmir in the bazaars. The fundamentalist demagogues in small towns threatening to march upon Islamabad if the Sharia and interest-free banking were not immediately introduced. The tribals in the so-called self-administering areas near the Afghan border cutting off a few arms in their attempts at proper Islamic justice. Almost every day, Sunnis murdered Shias and vice versa. A few young mujahideen achieved shahadat or martyrdom in Indian Kashmir. In the newspapers alone, while reporting on all-consuming religious obsessions, could take you to the point where you began to sense something hard and fierce in even the simple devotion of the skull-capped men half-prostrate on chilly evenings on the streets of Peshawar. But here I had to look out for my own prejudices. There had been many Muslims in the railway towns of North and Central India where I had grown up. I couldn't distinguish them from the low-caste Hindus among the railway labor gangs my father supervised. My father certainly had Muslim colleagues, but I cannot remember identifying any among the exhausted men in sweat-drenched white shirts and grey pants who returned home with my father for a cup of tea after a long day out on the tracks. Although the tea must have been served to them not in cups, but the special glasses kept aside in our kitchen for Muslims and low-caste Hindus. Most Muslims in the towns of my childhood were, in fact, very poor, much more so than us. And this was the reason I noticed them. They lived in ghettos inside the older parts of the town where, after the expansiveness of the British-built cantonment and civil lines and railway colony, the streets and houses suddenly shrank and were edged with open drains. The women disappeared behind sinister black burqas, flimsy rags curtained off the hanging carcasses at the butcher shops, and the gaunt-faced men with pointed beards standing outside dark houses looked quite capable of brutality that our prejudices as ascribed to them. The prejudices were bred partly by our own lower middle class deprivations, the anxieties about money, status, and security that came to be related in the usual unreflective way to the alien-looking community in our midst. We weren't the kind of people who incited or ever took part in Hindu-Muslim riots, But we did believe the stereotype that fueled these previous explosions of rage and despair. We had no trouble imagining the bearded Muslim as a fundamentally violent aggressor who could murder a Hindu with as much avidity and relish as he slaughtered the cow whose chopped up flesh, thrown inside temple courtyards, usually inaugurated the savagery. Another quite common and somewhat subtler cliché presented Muslims as backward looking, as a drag on modernizing India, if not fifth columnists for Pakistan. Of course, the blunter dismissal was, why don't these Muslims simply go to Pakistan? After all, India had been partitioned in 1947 to create a new homeland for Indian Muslims. Pakistan was what most of them had asked for, so what were they doing in India? It seems a crude question now, but it wasn't easy to answer, although politicians and other privileged men tried. However, their assertion that India was a secular country which was open to people from all religions didn't convince those of us, upper caste Hindus, who lived in straitened circumstances and practiced as well as suffered discrimination. And so, feeling frustrated and demoralized ourselves, we redirected most of the pity and scorn with which, if we could, we would have seen our own lives. Most Hindu women probably deserved as much sympathy as was expended in any cursory discussions of the minorities on Muslim women, who were imagined to be leading terribly oppressed lives, forced to breed like rabbits and wrap themselves in heavy burqas. The cliches bubbled up only when we noticed the Muslims. For the most part, this depressed minority was invisible and remained so for me even after I left home and went to university in Allahabad, where Hindu caste politics in the 1980s managed to overshadow Hindu-Muslim discord. In the late 1980s, when I moved to a university in Delhi, the Hindu nationalist agitation to demolish the Babri Mosque in Ayodhya had just picked up all over North India. There was much opposition to this inside my university campus. In fact, it was there, in the isolated and artificial world of university politics, that I became slightly more aware of the peculiar status of Indian Muslims. Student politicians organized almost daily protests inside the campus, which many of the Muslim students, most of whom came from the nearby riot-prone town of Aligarh, joined, and where one speaker after another denounced the Hindu nationalists for attempting to destroy the great Indian traditions of tolerance and accommodation. The fuss over a disused, tottering mosque in the middle of nowhere seemed excessive. Then came the day in December 1992 when the mosque was demolished by a frenzied Hindu mob. The student politicians in the campus raged for some weeks afterwards, but the Muslim students stayed away from their rallies. They appeared bitter and haunted. I began to look differently at them as they huddled around the dining table and spoke in low voices, eating swiftly all the while with their fingers. I still couldn't feel involved. I had my own anxieties to deal with. The university degree I was working towards was the only first stage in what then seemed a long, slow climb out of the relative poverty my family had lived in for much of my childhood. Occasionally, I would attend the after-dinner lectures by visiting left-wing journalists and academics, articulate suave men who discussed the historical bonds between Hindus and Muslims and the uniquely syncretic civilization of India. These ideas about India's past and present didn't always match my experience. The sense I had of the distrust and hostility between Hindus and Muslims and the keener sense I had in the course of my travels through small town India of the stagnant resentments of the Muslim ghettos. But I didn't have the courage to contradict them then, and even now feel insecure before such powerful liberal pieties. Pakistan has its own marginalized but vigorous liberals, Indeed, its small English language press is intellectually more adventurous and engaging than its Indian counterpart. This is probably because the country seems to have few pieties left from its 50 years of existence. The bookstores are full of such titles as The Years of Disillusionment and Wither Pakistan. The newspapers carry long letters by retired army men expressing concern over the number of educated Pakistanis wanting to emigrate. Very early in Pakistan's history, its foundational myth had been broken. A shared religion, it turned out, could not solve the problem of how people with different ethnic and linguistic backgrounds were to live together. Urdu-speaking Muslims from India, arriving in large numbers in Sindh, found themselves resented by the poor Sindhis, who in turn felt oppressed by the rich and dominant majority of the Punjabi speakers in the north. The Bengalis revolted and broke away in the early 1970s. The Balochi attempt to secede was put down with a lot of difficulty, and the disastrous Pakistani imperative to control events in Afghanistan grew out of the urgent need to pacify the Pashtun separatists of the northwest frontier. The country, which many Hindus in India still imagine to be the natural home of Indian Muslims, had created its own ghettos where resentments were anything but stagnant. So that was just a brief part of how he's describing his journey, he's drawing comparisons and making a lot of analysis, a lot of thinking is going on along with the traveling passages, a lot of comparisons, analysis, all that is going on. But as I said, that's just a small part, and when you read the book, you find in depth a lot of such experiences, a lot of such analysis. And the good thing is, at every point, at every experience, he's adding context, historical context to everything. He's giving you different lenses to look at all these historical events, all these life experiences. So that's it for today, but I will for sure tell you more about this book and certain other parts of it in the coming episodes. So stay with me, keep following, and we'll find out more about the book. Thank you very much for listening. Thank you.